Interview
We
with
were wondering if
Alan
you were really
Morris,
free last night, because the
Clerk of
time
the
zone has
House,
just changed.
Tallahassee, Florida,
It's
May
been
16th, 1974.
Now, what has really changed since you were interviewed for BOP's book?
Well, of course, the significant development has been the growth of the Republican Party as a state party. As you know, Republican presidential candidates had carried Florida prior to that time. But I think there are very strong Republican organizations in many counties. There are numerous state, county, municipal officials who are Republican. While the Democratic Party has tried to draw itself together with the revamping of the state executive committee, state committee having considerable money to spend, it has never really achieved the unity of the Republicans. Why that is, I don't know. Democrats just seem to fall apart at times. But I guess that happened to the Republicans too, in the Gurney-Kramer situation, which most people believe, most observers believe, was engineered by Governor Kirk, who was sort of a maverick Republican. As you know, he had been a Democrat and he turned Republican. But having a governor gave the Republican Party the patronage, it was quite helpful for during his 4 years. Unfortunate for the party in some ways that he wound up at odds with a good many of his own people. That was their big opportunity. He sort of blew it. He got the vice presidential bug at first.
Woody, would you bring the sergeant's keys to the office, please?
Party people saw a lot of their money being spent on furthering his personal political hopes.
Has that been the major change in the last 25 years, the growth of the Republican Party?
Yes, I think so. I would say so.
What were some of the other things you told her that you said you felt a little bit silly about now?
Well, one of the things that distressed me later was that I had conducted a poll on an airplane of maybe 10 members of the state senate to asking them who they would like to have on their side if they were candidates for governor. And we certainly turned out some strange people, gamblers. And maybe it was true at that time. I don't think they were kidding me with those circumstances. I guess it indicates that Florida has really changed in some ways that they were able to name, say, five or six people, and they thought with that five or six they could mount a statewide campaign. Well, no one could do that anymore. Florida in those days had perhaps 2 million people. television has come into it than a few newspapers. Their campaigning has taken on additional facets and sides.
What have been the basic changes in the legislature the last 25 years?
In 1967, a three-judge federal court in Miami finally took into its hands the drawing of the district lines. It took the control from the rural areas, transferred it to the suburbs. And it meant that the Republican Party became a significant force in the legislature. Having both just had to be reckoned with in both houses, while the governor Kirk was governor, there were enough Republicans in the legislature to sustain his vetoes. It also brought into the legislature many people who had had no prior political background. It just changed the atmosphere. I suspect that quite a number of the people who came to the legislature that year were people who simply either allowed their name to be used, perhaps without any thought ever of winning, and on the other side, the Democratic side, so many candidates qualified that others saw that this is a good chance for anybody to win, and people did. In Dade County, the legislative candidates mounted up to something like 200, and no voter could intelligently plow his way through the rank banks of names on the voting machine, though it made a great deal of change. And the class of 67, which fading now, presented the opportunity for numerous reforms to be achieved in the legislature, because you had so many people who didn't know that this wasn't the way it had always been done. And out of that came so many changes that Florida's legislature was ranked at the top in a number of categories by the Citizens Committee on state legislatures. So that was good. We have a year-round legislature now. Now, they don't meet year-round, but the committees are standing committees for 2 years. They're appointed when the presiding officers take office in November. Previously, presiding officers were installed in April. They appointed their committees then, and the committees went out of existence at the end of that session. We have a 60 consecutive day session, which amounts to 44 working days. 44 days didn't offer much of an opportunity for creativity. The legislature could barely keep up with stamping yes or no or maybe on bills which other people drafted and brought into the committees. Well, now each committee committee not only is in business for 2 years, each committee has is adequately staffed. The members for the first time have personal staffs in their districts. They have a district allowance, and all in all, they are equipped to do the sort of job that the people, I think, demand of them or want of them.
How much staff do they have in the district?
The senators have an administrative aide and a secretary. The House members have one or the other, either an aide or a secretary.
And what sort of salary is provided by that staff?
I could look it up, but I can't tell you off the cuff.
That's all right.
And what is the district allowance?
The district allowance presently is vouchered expenses up to $300 a month.
And that covers such expenses as what?
Rent, telephone, office supplies.
Would it include travel?
Travel within the district is an expense, yes.
When did the tradition start that you replace the Speaker and the President of the Senate every new legislature? And why did it start?
So far as I know, it started in the beginning. If you look back over the lists of speakers and presidents, you will not find but two or three instances where they repeated. Why it was, I don't know. I assume that it was felt it was an honor to be handed around, but the legislature may not have been as significant a force, and so therefore it didn't really matter that everybody wanted the opportunity to be speaker. But the custom was pretty firmly rooted beginning in the 1930s, the late 1930s, when the campaigns for president, for speaker, were run far in advance. Good night. Okay, good to see you. Good night. So that they were campaigning in 4 years in advance. Well, obviously the man in office didn't have a chance to be reelected. He was to some degree a lame duck at the time he took over. But we finally had an upheaval about that last year, and beginning after the next change of speaker, the system will be different. They will not be campaigning in advance, hopefully, and there will be a year's experience before the members are called upon to vote in a secret ballot for their nominee. That's on the Democratic side only, the majority side. And, you know, there are pros and cons to it.
So how will it work then?
At that time, in the 2nd January of the 2 year term, those members who wish to offer themselves for speaker pro tempore will make this known to the clerk. The clerk then will, after a cutoff date, will certify these are the candidates. Then there will be a secret ballot to select the officers.
And how is it done now?
It is done now on a pledge basis. And when some person gets a majority of the people whom he is then serving, but not the people who he would be the speaker of, they will call a caucus and confirm the results.
But in the change will still continue to have 1 year's House or one session. The House from one term elect the speaker for the following term.
Yes, that's no. That's desirable.
But that's not a legal thing. One house cannot bind another house.
Why is it desirable?
Well, it's obviously desirable because there needs to be a period of transition between the old speaker whose job will be finished. See, Mr. Sessom's job will be finished on May 31st of this year for all practical purposes. There will be a hiatus until Tucker takes over on November 19th. During that period, the incoming speaker, the speaker designate, has an opportunity to learn something of the ropes of being speaker. It's more important now than it once was because the House is a big business. It has hundreds of employees.
Has the governor traditionally taken a hands-off position on the election of a speaker?
He has nothing to do with it. So far as I know, he has never had anything to do with it.
Have any of them ever attempted to influence this election?
Have there been many fights like the one that's now coming up between Tucker and Harris? Have you had that kind of contest before?
Yes, sure.
Often?
No, not often. We had it 4 years ago. As you will know, this sort of fight results from the emergence of the Republican Party as a major force. This is a coalition situation. Prior to that, when the Democratic Party was a solitary party in the field, perhaps two or three or four Republicans out of the group, why the outcome of the Democratic caucus was conclusive, that was final. But it's the new element here is whether it might be possible join dissident Democrats with the Republicans, as has happened in other states. No one knows what it might come about here.
Have all these reforms in the legislature, the reapportionment, the staffing, the better salaries and so on, produced a better legislative product?
Well, I should hope so. And I would base that on the fact that the major legislation is the work product of committees now. An administrative code or criminal revision of the criminal code is something that could take two or three or 4 years, more time than any individual member could give to it. That's the sort of things that are coming through.
Does each committee have a full-time staff?
Yes.
How large?
Well, it depends on the committee. Appropriations has a staff director and perhaps six or seven or eight budget analysts plus the backup force of secretaries.
Can we get a legislative directory that would have this sort of information in it? Do you have such a directory?
We don't have it broken down. what we could give you would be a clerk's manual, which would show only the names of the committees and the staff directors and the committee secretaries, but not how many below them.
Is it your impression that Florida has one of the biggest legislative staffs in the country, or at least in the South?
Yes, I would think so. I think so, certainly in the South.
You've been clerk for how long?
Since 1966.
And then before that, you were, in effect, covering the legislature as a newsman, am I correct?
Mm-hmm. I was sort of on both sides of the fence. I developed an interest in the House of Representatives almost as soon as I came here in 41 as political editor of the Miami Herald. And I stayed here after the 43 session. And as early as 47, the House asked me to write its rules of procedure, which I did, and they were adopted in 49. So even while I was a newsman, I was also interested in the procedural side of the legislature.
When you came in 41, how large was the Capitol Press Corps?
Well, I was the first year-round person in the Capitol itself. The Associated Press had one or two men here down the street. So far as I know, I was the first be lodged in the Capitol itself.
We've been impressed with the both the size of the Capitol Press Corps in Tallahassee and also its aggressiveness.
I understand that our press corps is second only to that of California in size.
To what do you attribute the, at least what to us is perceived as generally pretty high quality insofar as aggressiveness of by journalistic standards?
Well, I think there are several reasons. First, Florida is perhaps different from many states in that there is no dominant newspaper. There are large newspapers in Jacksonville, Orlando, St. Petersburg, Tampa, Miami, and some pretty good moderate-sized papers elsewhere. That has set up a competitive situation here at the Capitol, which has worked out, I think, very well for the public interest. I think that's mainly the answer to it.
There's a seeming willingness on the part of publishers to invest more in Capitol coverage than in most states.
Again, it's a competitive urge, I believe. Florida, I think there's another element there. Florida is still a frontier state, a state of ferment, a state of great growth, which offers the publishers a reason to push out to constantly to new areas where the people are, where people are coming in. In many states, it's become static and the circulation boundaries are fixed. There is not as much reason for the promotional efforts of good staffing in the Capitol and elsewhere. When I came here, when I went back home from the 43 session, I told Lee Hills, the Miami Herald, that I thought the Herald, the time had come for the Herald to open Tallahassee Bureau. He said, no, we're looking to Latin America first. And they had several Latin American editions distributed by AIR. But I came back signed up a number of papers. And pretty soon there were others, and the Herald came in, Tribune was in. And I think it's one stimulates another. It's a pretty healthy situation.
How is that competition good for the public interest?
It seems to me that whenever you have reporters who are competitively rooting around in the government, it's bound to be in the public interest. It makes for a better government if the bureaucrats know that somebody's looking over their shoulders and telling the public what's going on.
Was the Capitol Press Corps largely responsible for the passage of the Sunshine Law?
I don't know whether it was largely responsible. I presume it could be said that although the idea did not originate with the press, it originated with a state senator from Gainesville who is now a judge. But once he started pushing it, and pushing it aggressively, he got a lot of help from the press.
Who is it? What's his name?
Emory Cross. Ray Cross.
Was the sit-in movement over in the Senate, that dramatic sit-in by several reporters, was that a key factor in mobilizing support for that bill? Was it a turning point?
No, the Sunshine Law had already been enacted. What the sit-in did was to put an end to executive sessions in the Senate.
The Sunshine Law allowed such, is that correct?
Yes, and the Constitution still does. It just happened to coincide with reapportionment, which changed the complexion of the Senate by causing what had been the minority to suddenly become the majority. And they had a president of the Senate. It turned up a president of the Senate who had always been very press conscious and who had been sort of a darling of the press, and he suddenly was confronted with this, and so he just decreed there'd be no more executive sessions, and no one since then has attempted to have an executive session, but the provision for it is still in the Constitution. There was a feeling among the press that executive sessions were being used for consideration of matters other than gubernatorial appointments and suspensions. That's what they were shooting at.
When Governor Askew was in the legislature, particularly in his early days when he was in the House and later in the Senate, and you were at least the beginning part of that, were observing as a newsman, am I correct?
Mm-hmm.
Did he stand out at that time in any way?
Yes. He stood out in a number of ways. Not the least of which was his stand on apportionment. His predecessor in the Senate had been one of the troops in the Porkchop Gang, while Senator, while Representative Askew defeated him, it was still felt that Panhandle Florida was pork-chop territory. So I felt that he had taken his political future in his hands by some of the things that he did. And said so. We have some columns I wrote about him. I think I first started paying attention to him when I learned that he, as a freshman member of the House, had returned a copy of a book of mine which had been sent to all members of the legislature by one of the interests. And he is the only person who ever, so far as I know, ever had returned one. He just didn't want, he didn't think it was the right thing to do to accept gifts. I think in subsequent years, what he realized this, maybe it wasn't an effort to buy him, it was an effort to better inform him and other members of the legislature. But, he got my eye when he did that. I presume you know that I publish a guide to the state and the government. It's started in 1946 and it's published every other year.
I did not realize it was published every other year.
It's used.
Is that the Florida handbook?
Mm-hmm. It's, since it's the only book in the field, it enjoys usage as a textbook in colleges and universities and in some high schools, but only because it's the only thing that's available.
How do we get one? How do we buy one?
Well, I hate to tell you, or I guess I should be happy to tell you, that it's sold out, this edition. It'll be in Elizabeth next April. It comes out coincidentally with the first regular session of the new legislature. This is what it looks like.
I've seen it.
And it's a repository of odd facts about the state, odds and ends, the firsts, all things of that stuff that needs to be tucked away so I don't have to burden my files. It's an outgrowth of a column I wrote when I first came to Tallahassee, a column called About Florida, which appeared three times a week in some 15 or 16 newspapers. And it asked and answered three questions about the state. So fairly soon I accumulated such a pile of material. And I also discovered that there are an awful lot of people in Florida who wanted to know about their state. Florida still has more than 50% of its people are from other states. And so they had no way of learning about the state, and many people had a genuine interest in it. So it seemed to me that this would be a good way to get a secondary benefit out of this material. And that in turn led to the establishment of the state's photographic archives, because I wanted to illustrate the book and found there was no place in the state that had a simple photographic collection. So that's the state's collection So one thing just leads to another.
How would you assess the various governors that you saw during that period, from 48 on?
Well, one of the problems of making an assessment of governors or legislatures or anything else in Florida is that the state has grown so fast that they're not faced with equal problems. I felt that Governor Warren's administration was one in which more things happened for the betterment of the state than any other. Now, many of the things that were started then were brought to fruition in succeeding administrations. I'm sure Governor Holland was a great governor, but he was governor during World War II when it was a holding operation. There wasn't anything the state government could have done. Couldn't even build roads. Governor Collins achieved, I suspect, the first national attention by a Florida governor since Napoleon Broward and the Three Friends and filibuster days, Cuban War days. But his administration in Florida was hamstrung by the events of integration and of reapportionment. He was the first governor to be elected to a successive term because he had been elected first to complete the term of the governor who died. So he had 6 years, but those 6 years were given over to intangibles, the high principles. I have a vast amount of respect for Governor Collins. But it's just unfortunate that he was fighting these moral issues. And that he contributed a good deal toward bringing Florida successfully through that period of transition on segregation, integration. He took stands which were certainly very unpopular, even in his own community, which, of course, had much to do with his defeat when he ran for the United States Senate. Governor Kirk received a great deal of national attention, too, of a different kind.
I'm about to ask you,
well, we're living in that part of history now. There is every reason to believe that he will be reelected. First governor to be elected to successive four-year terms since the Constitution was amended to make that possible. He has had an administration which has been almost, well, his office has been unblemished, and he has quickly gotten rid of those minor appointees who are involved in questionable activities. He's extremely sensitive to He hasn't changed since he came here as a representative.
Is he different from other politicians in that respect in Florida? Does he stand out as really being different?
Yes, I would think so. I don't want to fault Roy Collins. But I think Governor Askew is even more of a Presbyterian in his thinking than Governor Collins. And he's received some national attention. Florida is a large enough state to command some attention from the national parties. It's not beyond the realm of possibility that he might be considered for national office. Goes out. The peculiar structure of Florida's state government means that a very important part of the governor's position is furnishing moral leadership. As we saw during Governor Kirk's administration, this state government can go on without the governor. And even though there was a general reorganization in 1968, the members of the cabinet have a voice equal to that of the governor on the boards which run the departments of the state, which run many of the departments of the state. So it isn't as though you were in these states where the governor appoints the members of the cabinet.
Has some of the power of the cabinet shifted or moved to the legislature or to the governor in the last 10 years?
Both ways.
Is that going to continue?
It well could, in view of the upheaval in the cabinet these days. Legislature has, since 67, asserted itself as a co-equal branch of the government for the first time by reason of year-round committees and staffing, the transfer of the Auditor General to the legislative branch from the executive. Up until then, the executive audited itself, and shifting that to the legislature has made a considerable difference.
So you think that will continue?
Services, HRS, is responsible solely to the governor.
has been the, could you give us a comparison and contrast to the way the legislature, in particular the Senate, operated in the days of the pork chop gang and the way it works now? The way it works in terms of responsiveness to public issues and concerns, as well as just the mode of operation.
The rural domination of the Senate during the so-called pork chop days, I think, was expression by the senators of concern about their constituents as individuals. Whether Jim Jones was going to get a job as a game warden, or as a guard at Rayford, or as an attendant at a mental hospital. The suburban legislature tends to think of people collectively across the board. They are not as concerned about finding patrons, jobs, people. I think it makes a big difference.
So are they more issue oriented? Is that?